KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Black women are more than three times as likely as white women never to marry. And when black women do marry, they are more likely than any other group to wed a man who is less educated or earns less money than they do. Ralph Richard Banks' new book is called Is Marriage for White People? How the African-American Marriage Decline Affects Everyone. Banks spoke at the Northwest African-American Museum on March 13, 2012.
What's the law professor doing writing a book about marriage? Well, I teach at Stanford Law School. I teach a variety of courses related to race and gender inequality. One of those courses is family law. One of the central issues in family law is how the American family is changing. So the way I came to this book, actually, is through thinking about family change in the context of family law. And the book started out as a sort of purely academic book that was going to look at the intersection between family patterns and legal rules. And as I got into it more and more, frankly, the legal questions just became less interesting and people's lives became more interesting. So I began to put people's lives at the forefront of the book and to try to understand what was actually happening out in the social world. So I started off the way law professors do, though, by going to the library and, you know, reading what other people had written and looking at various studies. I started out with law and then quickly went to my other loves, sociology and psychology and education and history and economics. And I was beginning to write the book based simply on that academic research. And then one day, just by chance, in fact, I was talking to a woman who was a Stanford alum, as it turned out. I teach at Stanford. So we were talking and she was asking me what I was working on, and I talked about this book. She was very interested in it. This was an African-American woman. And then our conversation turned into a very long conversation. And I asked her, I was like, well, why are you so interested in this? And she said, well, because it seems like this book relates to my life in a way that other books had not. And then our conversation became an interview because it became clear that she wanted to not only hear about the book, she wanted to tell her own story and how what she had lived through fit into some of the issues that I was talking about. So I conducted that interview, almost as much to humor her, though, as much as to gain material, if you will, for the book. And the interview was really transformative. It was transformative for her because she was able to tell her story, but it was also transformative for me because I was able to uncover things or gain insights that I never would have gleaned simply by looking at the academic research. So after that interview went so well, I decided to do another interview, and then another, and then another, and then another. And this added up to over 100 interviews with men and women, and then it eventually slanted more toward women and more toward women in their 30s and 40s as opposed to much younger or much older. And interviews were conducted in cities throughout the nation, from the Northwest to California, to Southern California, to Chicago and Atlanta and New York and Detroit and Philadelphia and other places that I'm probably missing right now. So I conducted these interviews to try to get a sense of how the research conducted by scholars fit with people's actual lives. So the book that resulted is really a combination of the research, the academic research, which I think of as kind of starting at the top, and then people's actual experiences, which are sort of building from the bottom, right? And each sort of inform the other, right? The academic research sort of framed some of the issues I wanted to explore, but then the interviews gave me new insights into the academic research as well. So that's how I came to the book and how I went about it. And this was over the course of the better part of a decade, which I marked that time by when my children were born. So I started working on this before my youngest son was born. He's 8. But it was after my middle son was born, and he's 10. So it's just about, you know, 9 years ago that I started working on this and, you know, would work on it and then give it a break and then go back to it, and worked on it pretty intently for the last several years. So after that, the most common question I get is, where did I get this title from? And I admit that the title is, it is admittedly provocative, is Marriage for White People. I also admit that the title was not my choice initially. I had a lot of different titles in mind that were much more academic, along the lines of race, marriage, and inequality, the dynamics of a changing institution, or economic and cultural influences on families, or the market for relationships and its determinants. And I had a whole list of things, and I gave these to a research assistant one day, and I was really excited, and I said, well, tell me which one you like the most. And I knew one of those was the winner. And she looked at this list of titles on the page, and she just shook her head. She said, these are boring. I said, wow. And I said, really? She said, yeah, so boring they put you to sleep. And then I looked at her. I said, well, you're pretty blunt. Maybe even too blunt. And she looked at me without missing a beat, and she said, well, you have someone else to lie to you, don't you? I said, okay, so I know she's telling me the truth. So then we didn't have a title for a while. And then I came across an article that was written in the Washington Post. And this article recounted a journalist's visit to an elementary school in Washington, D.C., in Southeast Washington. And the journalist was there to be a role model on Career Day and was talking to the children about you know, their options and their future and having high aspirations and being a good person. And then the talk turned to parenting. And one of the little boys wanted to talk about parenting. And the journalist said, great, I'll bring in someone, a married couple, to talk to you about raising children. And the little boy said, no, 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 we're not concerned about married couples. And his friend said, yeah, because marriage is for white people. And that shocked the journalist, because that was as stark an expression as one could imagine of the fact that in this little boy's world, this sixth grade boy's world in Southeast Washington, D.C., he saw so few black people getting married and staying married that he didn't think that was something black people did. He thought that was only something that other people did. So I wanted to, I appropriated that title and made it into a question. I made it into a question that is, admittedly, it's loaded in a way, right? Because I like the fact that it captures the emotional valence of a lot of the issues that I explore, frankly. So one meaning of the title then is marriage for white people but not for black people? That's what the little boy meant. He was suggesting that marriage was not for black people. But I like the title for another reason as well, because the title has another meaning. This is, in fact, the more straightforward interpretation of the title. Is marriage for white people? Right? Is marriage even for white people? Is marriage for anyone? And that was an interpretation of the title that I also wanted people to embrace, actually. Right, because one of the goals of the book is the goal of the book is both to highlight the African American experience, but also to show how the African American experience is emblematic, representative of a more general American experience, and that's really a key point in this book. Right, and this was something that I wanted to do because, you know, over the years I've been frustrated with how discussions of race typically occur apart from discussions of other issues in society. So when someone talks about African Americans and family and how families are changing, that's kind of a discussion about African Americans and about African Americans alone. On the other hand, when somebody talks about how marriage is changing in society, the discussion would be about everyone, it would be about society in general. Would not devote any attention to African Americans. By default, it would mostly focus on whites. So you'd have a discussion about societal changes that focus on whites generally. Then you'd have a discussion about African Americans that are limited to African Americans and doesn't bring other people into the story at all. And so I wanted to try to undo or counteract that sort of intellectual segregation, if you will. So what I wanted to do was to write a story that basically says, you know, a lot of times when people talk about what's happening with African Americans and African American families, we talk about those families as if they're different, as if they're distinct, as if they're deficient even. But in fact, African American families are representative of American families. The same things that happen with African Americans are happening with everyone. It's just that the developments are starker or more extreme among African Americans. So that was the key point that I wanted to emphasize, and I wanted the title of the book to capture that, to highlight both the particularity and the universality of the story. So so that was where I that was where the title came from. And let me just give one example of how to be clear. Throughout the book, I talk a lot about how patterns with whites follow patterns with blacks, right? So if we want to understand what's going to happen to American society generally, or whites in particular, we could do no better than to look at what's happening now with African Americans. Because African Americans are often on the forefront of social change, on the forefront of developments which will soon sweep through all of society, right? And the most salient example of this relates to unwed childbearing. In the 1960s, only a few percent of white children were born to unmarried parents. Almost 25% of black children were born to unmarried parents. Now the number is above 25% for white families. Right, so white women are more likely to have children without being married now than black women were in the 1960s. Among young white women, the numbers are even higher. If you look at young white women in their early 20s, about 60% of them have children without being married. So that's the number that would have seemed unimaginable in the 1960s when we imagined that the changes with respect to childbearing were limited to African Americans. But in the decades that followed, it became clear that they weren't limited to African Americans. They were actually a result of changes that were most apparent among African Americans, but in fact would envelop all of society.
Ralph Richard Banks, Stanford University law professor and the author of Is Marriage for White People? How the African American Marriage Decline Affects Everyone. Banks spoke at the Northwest African American Museum on March 13, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Heidi Lang recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Ralph Richard Banks in a moment. 919, 94.9 KUOW. As part of a campaign to protect nature's less attractive creatures, voters pick the blobfish as the ugliest animal in the world. We'll hear about it in the 11 o'clock hour tonight. For the first time in a century, the 10% of Americans taking in the most money have accounted for more than half of the country's income. A conversation about how America's growing wealth inequality affects our society, politics, and economy tonight at midnight. Lows around 60 tonight, says the forecast for the Seattle area. Clear this evening, then becoming cloudy. Areas of fog after midnight. Friday highs 70s to lower 80s, mostly cloudy in the morning with areas of fog, then becoming sunny. Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Sounders FC. The Sounders take on division leaders Real Salt Lake this Friday night at CenturyLink Field. More information and tickets for Friday's match at SoundersFC.com.
KUOW and Seattle Center present Festal, a year-long series of events highlighting the distinct cultures and common threads of ethnic communities in the Pacific Northwest. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Wu Sing Dao, a classical five-element acupuncture school offering a master's level program for working adults. Open house Tuesday, September 17th at 6:30 p.m. Enrolling now. Fall classes begin November 14th. More at WUHSING.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Is marriage for white people? A provocative question, sure. Well, that's the title of Ralph Richard Banks' new book. He spent nearly a decade collecting research and interviews for the book, which attempts to answer the question of why marriage has declined in the United States through an exploration of the black middle class. Banks spoke at the Northwest African American Museum on March 13th, 2012.
Another development that the book explores is a changing economic position of spouses, right? So wives are more likely than ever to earn more than their husbands. In 1970, only just very 2 or 3% of wives earned more than their husbands. Now it's about 1 in 4. But again, that development is most apparent among African Americans. If we look at college-educated black women, for example, more than half of them are better educated or higher earning than their husbands. Right? So half of college-educated black men are better educated or higher earning than their husbands. That's an unprecedented development. What underlies both of these developments is another one that is, can only be described as heartbreaking in a way. Which is that for African Americans in particular, as women have moved ahead, economically, and that's a good thing. That's a positive development. Women have moved ahead economically and educationally over the last several decades, but black men have fallen behind. And we see this in a number of different areas. Black women are about twice as likely as black men to graduate from college. It's nationwide. Nearly twice as many black women as men graduate from college every year. This development is occurring at the same time that a college degree has become more essential for job stability, for economic success, and at the same time as the work environment for blue-collar men, as men without a college education, has become the worst it's been in our lifetimes, frankly. Right? I mean, I come from a family of men who worked at steel mills. This is in Cleveland, Ohio. Worked at steel mills or auto plants at Republic Steel or Ford Motor Company. And the jobs that my uncles had in 1970, those jobs don't exist. And when they do, they don't pay what they used to. So we have large numbers of black men who are not going to college, maybe not even graduating high school, and entering a work world where the jobs that they would have had 40 or 50 years ago don't exist. And what happens to those men who don't graduate high school or who don't go to college? Well, many of them, the majority of the high school dropouts, in fact, end up in prison or jail. This is another big problem, right? And that's part of a, as we speak right now, about 1 in 10 black men, or a little bit more than 1 in 10 black men, are actually in prison or jail nationwide. Some estimates are that 1 in 4. Some even say as many as 1 in 3 will spend some time in jail over the course of their life. And this is a marker of how disadvantaged African-American men have become, right? So the gap between men and women has led both to a decline in marriage because the men are not, there are not enough men who are attractive enough partners in terms of stability and having a job and so forth for black women to see them as good husbands. And then it also contributes to more relationships where the woman supports the family because the husband cannot, where the woman earns the bulk of the income and the husband is unable to. So that's the sort of the sketch of the sort of setup of the story. Marriage has declined to an unprecedented extent. The economic position of the spouses has shifted. These are society-wide changes, but they're especially apparent among African Americans. And they're most apparent among African Americans because black men are more disadvantaged than other groups of men, largely. That's what makes the difference. And this account sort of raises a question. And this is what really propelled me through the book, or this is what my editor calls the jelly in the donut, I guess, is that, you know, black women have the smallest pool of men within their race, because black men are disadvantaged for a whole host of reasons. Yet black women are also the least likely to marry someone of another race. And that's puzzling. Right? Black women have the smallest group of men within the race because black men are so disadvantaged, yet black women are the least likely to marry outside the race. Right? Black men marry non-black partners between 2 and 3 times as frequently as black women do. About 1 in 4 black men will marry someone who's not African American in terms of recent marriages. For black women, it's less than 1 in 10. If you look at Asian Americans or Latinos as well, they're 3 or 4 or 5 times as likely as black women even to marry someone outside of their group. So we have rates of interracial marriage increasing for all minority groups and even for whites, but less so for black women. And so one of the puzzles that the book tries to unravel is, why is it that although there's a shortage of black men, black women are the least likely to marry a man of another race? And that's a puzzle that has lots of different pieces. One of the pieces relates to the desires of women, and that some women don't want anyone other than black men, and there are a lot of reasons for that. One piece relates to the desires of non-black men, right? That is, there's a lot of evidence that black women are not at the top of the list for some non-black men in terms of desirability. But that's not the whole story, right? Because, and especially it's not the whole story that non-black men are not interested in black women. Because in fact, even though some men are not interested, there are a lot of others who are. And the group of black women is actually a small group relative to the numbers of non-black men. So there are a lot of men out there of all different races, not simply white men, but Asian Americans and Latinos and Middle Easterners and all different groups of men. And that group of men who are interested in black women is almost certainly larger, in fact, than the group of black women. So why don't more relationships form between black women and non-black men? Lots of pieces to the puzzle. Let me just highlight a few more. One relates to stereotypes that groups have of each other. So I think of this, I can't help but frame this in terms of my own experience when I was in high school, right? And we would be in a room like this, and the girls are on one side of the room and the boys on the other side. This is at the school dance. Saturday night, 9 o'clock, the lights are down, the chaperones are there, but, you know, everybody wants to do their thing, right? And the girls are on one side, the boys are on the other side, and you find out later that the girls are over on one side saying, why didn't he ask me to dance? He must not like me. But they didn't realize that we were over on the other side saying, I don't know if I should ask her to dance. She might say no. Because nobody wants to make that walk across the floor, right? And have to make the walk back. Nobody wants to do that, right? So we're looking over there trying to figure out if they're interested. And, you know, your own insecurity makes you think that they're not. They're looking at us thinking if we're interested, and they conclude, well, he's not asking me to dance, he must not be interested. So the irony is that actually you might, the boy might want to dance with the girl, and the girl might want him to ask her to dance and want to dance with him, but it might not happen because they each have a perception that the other side is not interested, right? Fortunately, what happens in high school is that you will usually have a friend in common. And over time, the friend will come and say, well, actually, she does want to dance with you. And then you know, right? So you've gotten this information, or you've gotten a note, or you've gotten some kind of clue that she's interested, and then you can act on that, right? But in the world that many people inhabit, especially when we're talking about people of different races, they don't have the intermediary. The go-between, the person who can deliver the information and let someone know, oh, well, they are interested in you. So you can have people who, in fact, are interested in each other, but neither perceives that the other is interested, right? And with black women and non-black men in particular, because people are raised in different settings and different norms, there's a real risk that the signals that one side might give off might not be correctly interpreted by another. So, you know, and I have a lot of stories about this in the book that, you know, one woman said, yeah, you know, a guy came and, you know, he asked to sit next to me at this restaurant, at this, you know, I don't know, at a bar of some sort. And then he asked what time it was. And I thought he was just tired and he wanted to know what time it was. And she said, well, if he was a black man, she would have known whether he was trying to talk to her or not. But because he wasn't, she wasn't able to decode the signals, right? Or from the other side, a man says, oh, well, you know, I didn't ask her out because I didn't think she was interested. And you say, well, why didn't you think she was interested? He says, well, because she didn't smile at me. But then you ask her, and she says, oh, no, I was interested. That was my sexy look. But he just didn't perceive that, right? So you have this mismatch, right? And researchers, social scientists call this a situation of pluralistic ignorance, which is to say everybody is ignorant or has a misperception of the desires of the other group. And if each party has a misperception of the desires of the other group, then people could actually be open at least to something, but they would never explore it because each thinks that the other is not interested. So that's one piece of the puzzle. Another piece of the puzzle was surprising to me. This is a sort of one big piece of the puzzle because we usually think about relationships as based on what people want, right, and people's desires. But the more I talked to people, the more convinced I became that one of the reasons we don't see relationships forming more across group lines is because of fear. People have all sorts of anxieties and worries that cause them not to, as a friend of mine says, get out of their comfort zone. And these worries and anxieties come in a variety of packages or relate to a variety of concerns. Sometimes people are worried about acceptance. They are worried that you know, their family would accept a partner of a different race. They're worried that the partner's family would accept them. They don't know how things are going to work out. And that's a lot of what keeps people apart. And again, these are concerns that everyone has, but they're especially acute in the case of African Americans and in the case of black women and non-black men in particular. So let me just read a little bit because I can't resist. So Cecilia is one of the people I talk about in the book. I have a number of characters, if you will, that I go back to, and all the names have been changed. And one of these characters is Cecilia. So Cecilia married an African-American man, and then they got divorced. And, you know, she's sort of reflecting on her life and her relationships. So years before Cecilia had met Daryl, who was a husband she later divorced, there had been another smart, funny man in her life. He was a law school classmate. She relished his jokes and admired his intellect. Their relationship progressed from hanging out after class to studying together to late night meals to sexual intimacy. All went well until they confronted that familiar question. What does this relationship mean? Where is it going? I don't just want to have sex. I want to be a couple. That's what he told her. And she responded, I'm not interested in being a couple. Sex, hanging out, fun, that's all this can be. The problem? He was white. And Cecilia couldn't imagine, quote, bringing some white dude to Detroit to sit up in my parents' house. She even told him, I'm not letting you meet my mama. When her best friend later asked why the relationship had ended, Cecilia explained matter-of-factly, he tried to get all serious on me. Had to let that go. Only in hindsight did she recognize why she ended it. Fear. She worried about whether their relationship would be accepted by his family, by her family, by their communities. She worried about the biracial children they might have. So there was a part of her she'd never let him reach. Had he been black, she says, I probably would have been in love with him. So that's just one example of some of the fears people have. And these fears are well-grounded, again. I mean, there's a reason that people worry about whether the family will accept the partner. I interviewed a lot of couples, and, you know, some of these were couples who had, you know, couples who dissolved, couples who stayed together, couples who were married recently, couples who were married many years ago. One couple was a couple who had met in Chicago. This is a white woman and a black man. And the white woman's father was the pastor of a church that stressed multiracial reconciliation. And they had summer camps where this is in the 70s. They had camps where they would bring children of different racial groups together to show the importance of brotherhood. And one day this young lady met a brown boy at one of these camps that she took a liking to. But she was white. And when she went and told her father, he made a point of telling her immediately, well, you took that idea a little too far. But she really liked this boy. So she tried to stick with him. They eventually went to college together. When her parents found out, they did what they could to pull her out of college. Only through heroic maneuvers on her part was she able to remain in college. They eventually decided they wanted to marry. When they made that announcement, the father, who was head of a church in the Midwest that was built on the idea of multiracial reconciliation, almost lost his job. They were threatened. Church members left the church. Family members said they would disown her. Family members did disown her. Their wedding was boycotted by many members of her family. To this day, she remembers that her mother never took her out to buy a wedding dress, never joined her in any of the pre-wedding rituals that a young daughter might want her mother to take part of. But they persevered. I mean, they're married. They've been married now, have grown children and grandchildren. Eventually, her family did come around, but it took many, many years. So there's it's justifiable for people to worry that families might not accept partners of a different race.
Ralph Richard Banks, Stanford University law professor and the author of Is Marriage for White People? How the African-American Marriage Decline Affects Everyone. Banks spoke at the Northwest African-American Museum on March 13th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Heidi Lang recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Ralph Richard Banks in a moment, 940, 94.9 KUOW. Zoran Popovich has a computer game that can teach 92% of first graders how to do algebra in 90 minutes. It's a tool he developed for schools through the University of Washington Center for Game Science. He tested it in a number of Seattle public schools at the end of the school year last year. The striking results of that experiment have arrived just in time for the new school year. Here's Zoran talk about them tomorrow at noon. Lows around 60 tonight, clear this evening, then becoming cloudy, areas of fog after midnight. Friday highs 70s to lower 80s, mostly cloudy in the morning with areas of fog, then becoming sunny. Michael Feinstein's guest this week on Song Travels is award-winning R&B singer-songwriter James Ingram. The fun gets underway at 10 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine, delivering primary and specialty care to patients at Harborview Medical Center, UW Medical Center, Northwest Hospital, Valley Medical Center, 9 UW Neighborhood Clinics, and Airlift Northwest. More information at uwmedicine.org. Support for KUOW comes from SolvoList.com, a worldwide classified listing site offering employment postings, buying, selling, and rental information of goods and services, with opportunities for unlimited posting open to all. Details at SolvoList.com, now available on smartphones.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Black women are more than three times as likely as white women never to marry. Ralph Richard Banks is a law professor at Stanford University. His new book is called Is Marriage for White People? How the African-American Marriage Decline Affects Everyone. Banks spoke at the Northwest African-American Museum on March 13, 2012. Next, he talks about the fears both whites and blacks experience when they marry someone of a different race.
I talked to one couple, a black woman and a white man, who'd been married 10 years. And the wife said that her husband had never met his father-in-law. And I asked the wife, well, how could that be? And she said, well, they live in California. And she said, my family's in Mississippi. And I said, well, certainly you've gone back to visit. And she said, well, yeah, but my dad was not interested in meeting my husband. This has gone on for years. And I said, well, does that bother you? And she said, well, it used to. But frankly, I can understand. I said, what do you mean? She says, well, my father went through a lot being raised in Mississippi. He went through a lot with white people that left him feeling not as open-minded as one might, you know, imagine people would should feel about people from other groups. And when she said that, it reminded me of my own family, because my own family, my parents are both deceased, but you know, frankly, if my if I or my siblings had married someone who was white, I don't know if my parents would have been so happy about it. That has a lot to do with their experiences growing up, right? So my father's family, just to take one side, my father was born in Georgia, in what was a little town outside of Atlanta, Lithonia, Georgia. And he remembered vividly the day when they left Georgia, because that day began on the good note of his brother wearing a new suit into town. His teenage brother wore a new suit into town, a simple thing. Brother was very proud of that. When he arrived in town, though, he was met with, nigga, you think you better than us? Before you knew it, an ice cream cone was smashed against his suit. Shoves were exchanged. And not long after, bullets were flying. Before the sun rose the next morning, my father's family, all of them, were on a train to Cleveland. That's how they left Georgia. That's the type of story that a lot of black families had about leaving the South, right? It's not the sort of thing that's talked about a lot, not the sort of thing that they dwell on, But it is the sort of thing that makes people less than enthusiastic about regarding as family someone from the group that they viewed as oppressing them. So I unpack a lot of that in the book through stories, right? So this is sort of, you know, that's some of what is underlying the lack of acceptance that you see in some families. It's a bitter history or past that has shaped people in which they carry within them. So those are some of the issues. Maybe I'll read one more little segment and then we'll just open it up for questions. This is one of the things that surprised me the most. One of the fears people have, some of the fears people have are about acceptance by family and friends. Other fears that people have are about whether the relationship could work, whether their partner would understand them and accept them. That issue came up a lot. So here's a segment about that. Some women worry about white men in particular who don't know anything about black women. As one woman says, I worry that with the white guy, I won't be able to be myself, that I could never really relax, that I'd always have to explain myself. Indeed, some of the women I interviewed did have to explain themselves to men who weren't black. One 31-year-old school teacher in D.C. told me she dated an Asian man once who was nice but just didn't get it. Simple things. I was putting on my scarf one evening before going to bed, she recalls. And he said, what are you doing to your hair? As she recounts the story to me, she rolls her eyes and cocks her head, just as I imagine she did with him. I was like, hun, let's have a little talk. I told him that I cover my hair at night, every night. To his puzzled why, she responded, because it stays where I put it, and if I don't, I wake up and it's all over my head. He understood, but it was a conversation she would rather have skipped. It's easy to date a black man, she told me, because he knows about my hair. He knows I don't wash it every day. He knows I'm going to put the scarf on. Many of the black women I spoke with don't want to have to explain themselves to their partner. They don't want to have to educate some man about black women, much less black culture. Even if he were open to learning, the mere fact of needing to have a conversation about, say, hair care is a problem. Among some women I interviewed, just the thought of having the hair talk made them tired, emblematic as it was of so much else they'd have to teach. Much better to have someone who already understands. So, I don't know much about hair, right? But, and that's a simple issue, right? And it seems almost trivial, at least from my vantage point. It seems almost trivial. But it's emblematic of really much broader issues, right? It's emblematic of this divide that people fear and that often exist, right, between groups. That divide was also memorably captured, and I'll close after this by a woman who is a black woman who lived in the Bay Area, in San Francisco area, at the time that the O.J. Simpson verdict came down. This is the verdict in the criminal case. O.J. Simpson was prosecuted for the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, and the verdict came down that he was not guilty. And she was just out of college and was working in an all-white environment with mostly white women. And she remembers they had the television on and they were watching this, and when the verdict was decided, everyone's mouth fell open. And the women were all aghast at this great injustice, at this travesty. They didn't know what to say. They didn't know how the jury could not find him guilty. They were almost speechless. They were so shocked by it. And this woman, this black woman, she didn't think that he was innocent necessarily, but she had a very complicated set of feelings about the O.J. Simpson case. because she also knew that there were lots of black men who probably had been convicted for things they didn't do. She knew that there was injustice in the society, and that African Americans were on the wrong side of that too often. She knew that there were lots of problems related to race and criminal justice. So she didn't see the great injustice as, you know, O.J. Simpson wasn't convicted. And as her coworkers focused on O.J. Simpson going free, she felt it ever more difficult to voice this complicated set of feelings she had. She wanted to let it out, but she didn't feel that with this group of white coworkers that she was comfortable doing so. So she left work needing to talk to someone. The only problem was that her boyfriend at the time was white. And they had gotten along well, right? They had fun, they went out, and they, you know, enjoyed life together. But she had never had to talk to him about something like this. And as she admitted, she didn't feel like talking to any white person about this. So she drove around for hours before going home, because he was going to be there, and she didn't want to have this talk. But eventually she did, and when she got home, they had to have the talk. And as she described it, he was as understanding and as sympathetic as any white person could be. Very liberal. He understood what she was feeling, he said. But even though he said he understood, for her that wasn't enough. He was sympathetic to her views, but he didn't feel them. He tried to understand how she saw the world, but it actually wasn't how he saw the world, because he had never been black. Not long after this, they broke up. Not because of O.J. Simpson, but O.J. Simpson did highlight a divide that she thought they simply could not get over. So again, these fears of a lack of understanding or lack of commonality, these fears are justifiable, but they also work to keep people apart. You know, so those are some of the issues. So this was a nonfiction book, but it's kind of written a little bit like a novel, I guess, in the sense that there are surprises along the way. So I can't reveal how it ends. I don't want to spoil that, but I will say that what I try to do repeatedly is to, you know, take seriously, you know, people's experiences, and just to try to understand how people are making the decisions they make and what's shaping those decisions, and, you know, what some of the trade-offs involved are, to try to understand, you know, how we've reached this point where, black women unfortunately have the smallest pool of partners within the race, yet are the least likely to go outside of the race. At that, we should have discussion.
The black women that you spoke to, what was their, like, predominant emotion about their situation?
What was the emotion about it? Well, so, yeah, I mean, so I think people move through life in different stages. So what was the emotion of people who weren't married and might have wanted to be married? So, you know, often there's a time, so I have a niece. Well, I shouldn't say this even. I have know a young woman who shall remain nameless. strike that. Who might want to be married, right? And when you're in your 20s, you know, you can be anxious about that, right? Because you're thinking about it and you want that to happen. But by the time you get to 40, if that hasn't happened, you got to move on, right? And it may just be that that's not going to happen, at least in the time for you to have children and all of that, that's not going to happen. And so, you know, you move on. And it may not be the way you envisioned it, but none of our lives really work out the way we envisioned it early on. If mine had, I would have played guard for the New York Knicks, but that didn't happen. But I moved on. So I think that's what people do, is they move on, right? But it is important because it is the case, and then this reproduction issue is a big one. Because black women are, one of the consequences of the lack of partners, because black men are not doing as well, is that black women are more likely than any other group to have children without being married. And they can make that work, but that's not the way you start out. You know, you don't start out thinking, boy, it would be great to have a child and, you know, not have the father there to help me raise the child. You don't start out that way. But people end up in that situation because the partners don't seem to be, are not appealing enough, right? Or don't seem to be promising enough to make marriage worthwhile. But there's another thing that happens with college-educated African-American women, or with women with advanced degrees, graduate degrees in particular. And this is another thing that was surprising to me. I found out that based on census data, black women with graduate degrees, master's degrees, law degrees, medical degrees, are the most likely of any group of women in the nation to not have a child. We have the highest rate of childlessness among these very highly educated black women. And you know, the obvious explanation for that is that these are a group of women who actually don't want to have the child without being married. And their white counterparts, you know, put themselves into their career, and then they get married when they're 32, and then they have a child when they're 34, and everything works out. But for black women, that deal doesn't come together sometime. And so then they don't have children biologically. But then they live with it, right? Because black women also, and we don't have, you know, some of the data here is a little spotty, but as far as we can tell, black women are disproportionately represented among single women who adopt children. Right? And as one woman said, she said, you know, that's what I want to do, because I felt like if I have a child and I'm not married, I just feel like I'm in a way, this is her view, I'm contributing to a problem. But if I adopt a child, I'm helping to solve a problem. And there are a lot of women who feel that way. So that's part of the dynamic. So let me close. We're going to close. Let me just close with one story like that, or one story. Here's a story. Okay. Tyrone, like every man Patricia Pullman had dated, is African-American. I always liked black men, she says. Dark, big, bulky, unmistakably black men. Throughout her college years in the late 80s at UCLA, this Los Angeles native maintained her relationship with Tyrone, the high school boyfriend whose formal education ended at graduation. After college, when her white coworker tried to set Patricia up with her brother, Patricia resisted. But eventually she agreed to go out with him, as a favor, one time only. But the date went so well that Patricia wanted to have another one. The interaction between them was easy, as she said. I can't describe it any other way. We were both comfortable. He's smart. We had similar interests. We liked travel. She says the story is so drama-free, it's boring. Their relationship naturally progressed, she says, as it became clear how well-suited they were for each other. And although Patricia had not once in her life thought of white men as attractive, when she looked at this particular man, really looked at him, she could see that he was. With his wavy dark hair and broad shoulders, the sex appeal was there. It still is. They've been married a decade.
Ralph Richard Banks, Stanford University law professor and the author of Is Marriage for White People? How the African-American Marriage Decline Affects Everyone. Banks spoke at the Northwest African-American Museum on March 13, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Heidi Lang recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.